Thank goodness.
We're going to start, even though we don't have a quorum. And I want to notice that there's a few nurses in the audience. Welcome to your capital, and thanks for the service you provide. Are there any nurses on this side, too? The more clandestine nurses are not wearing the red. Nice to have you here, too. We're going to talk about some things interesting to you today, a lot of mental health matters and other things. And Dr. Sulik has been prepping for this for some time, and he's got a spellbinding array of thoughts to give us. And so, Dr. Sulik, we've got maybe a half hour to get through some stuff, and we'll take questions maybe also.
Great.
So go ahead and tell us who you are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Dr. Reed Sulik, the Assistant Commissioner for the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I was here last week presenting our budgetary change pages for my administration. I have three change pages to present and complete my portion of the presentation. My goal is to easily accomplish that within 30 minutes
okay.
so that we can move on.
You need to fill up the entire time, however. Don't feel any break.
I would like to turn your attention. You now do have a handout available to you. Should be this one. And I believe last week there wasn't a copy of these available to members of the committee. But if we just turn to page 6, I'll pick up where I left off, starting with budgetary change pages that are specific to state-operated services. So this is the video portion of the presentation.
Yeah. That's the paper light.
There we go. This is the state-operated services pension reform plan. This is on budgetary page 139. And again, just to remind you of what I'll try to do in this presentation, I'll present a slide highlighting the issue being addressed by the budgetary change page. The second slide will highlight the action being proposed in the change page, and the third will be a review of the impact and the potential impact that we have thought through this. So the issue at hand is that currently the enrollment in the Corrections Early Retirement Plan has expanded beyond its original intent. The history here is, first of all, let me state that this particular change page is also being heard in the Pensions Committee, and I believe it's already been heard in the Pensions Committee. So we can I can go as quickly through this as you all would like, but I'll just give you a little bit of background to this. The Corrections Early Retirement Plan was enacted in 1973 to provide an early retirement option to corrections officers and security counselors whose primary purpose was security within the corrections system. Under the CERP, qualified employees are eligible to retire at age 55. Over the years, this plan has been expanded beyond corrections officers and security counselors to other Department of Corrections staff, as well as a number of Department of Human Services employees who work at three different facilities within the Department of Human Services, one being the Minnesota Security Hospital, second being the Minnesota Extended Treatment Option Program, and third being the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. The action being proposed here is to limit enrollment in the plan to those positions that are only related specifically to security functions within the Minnesota Security Hospital, as well as within MEDO. To move non-security positions from the CERP to the state general employee retirement plan, to limit eligibility for paid medical insurance upon retirement at age 55, and to expand vesting periods from 3 years to 10. DHS currently employs a total of 1,344 staff who are currently enrolled in the CERP. Of that number, 141 are employed at the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options Program in Cambridge, that's MEDO. 555 are employed at the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter. And although not in my particular administration, but I'll highlight that there are 648 employed at the Minnesota Sex Offender Program in Moose Lake and St. Peter combined. So under this proposal, about 808 positions would remain within the state currently. And then the impact of this particular proposal is that it clarifies who's eligible to participate in a specific plan, and it does, there is a proposed savings of $4.2 million for the biennium. Again, while we are well aware that this has impact on employees, this was one option that came up as a way of trying to mitigate staff reductions by looking at areas where we could reduce overall costs. And if there's any specific questions on that.
Thank you, and this is controversial, I understand. Actually, in honor of the day, Officer Murphy herself, a nurse, has a question, so it's uncanny. Officer Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hey, nurses. I have just a couple of questions about this provision, and I'm wondering if you can share with us a little bit about how you define security in terms of this provision. I know there are different job descriptions, but when this was when this pension provision was discussed, a number of years ago, the rationale for adding some of the non-security staff to this pension was because of the relationship between their work and their risk in terms of their interactions with inmates. And I'm wondering if that risk has changed for those non-security personnel. That'd be my first question. And then my second question would be, what do we do about the people who have been paying into this pension when we take them out? What do we do about the contributions that they've made to that pension?
Dr. Felix.
Mr. Chair, Representative. First of all, as far as the definition of who would remain eligible would be specifically security officers. And because Minnesota Security Hospital, for instance, has a very wide array of staff under employment at the Minnesota Security Hospital, any employees not directly involved with security functions would be removed from eligibility for this program. That does impact our direct care staff. The nurses at Minnesota Security Hospital, other direct care staff, other professional staff there as well. In regards to has the risk changed, I mean, essentially Minnesota Security Hospital is caring for perhaps the most complex and ill individuals suffering from a mental illness in the state, individuals that have been determined not only mentally ill, but mentally ill and dangerous. And therefore, there is a risk assigned to that program, and this is by no means undermining the risk that is there. And I don't think that the risk has changed, but I do believe that it's really looking for some clarity in the definition of the word security officer versus care staff. The second thing in regards to the proposal to and what the employees have paid into this, I think that the way that I understand it is individuals who are not currently vested. Well, there's two things to come into play. Those individuals who would be eligible have an extension of vesting. They have to have been employed by 10 years before they can be eligible for the retirement package. And in regards to the other question specifically about employees who have currently been eligible and then are no longer being eligible, I have to look into the answer for that question and get back. I have a sense that there's not anything that has been directly paid in that they would not be eligible to the general retirement fund, but I'd like to clarify that before I answer specifically.
And just one thing to members, we have to get through, I think, three pages of Dr. Sulik and then some other parts on the topic of children and family services. So we'll talk all we can, but I just, and so maybe we'll let them, I mean, you can follow up if you want. I'm not trying to cut you off, I just want to focus our task here. And this will be taken up in pensions with some vigor, I would expect. So. Representative Anzel, do you want to ask?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not just talking.
Somehow I knew that, but
we have a need here to. First of all workers are vested after 5 years, and when transfers of public workers from one pension fund to another fund occurs. Usually there's portability between all of these funds, and the fund from which they were transferred has to be made whole somehow in order that the workers that remain in that fund don't get penalized because the amount of dollars within their fund has been subtracted because the governor has chosen to make this move. I I really wonder how we get a savings here.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe the savings comes in the early retirement eligibility.
Oh, yeah.
Being able to retire at age 55.
You're a brave man to be here on Nurses Day talking about changing that system. And Representative Murphy has, I think we'll do, want to get away? Representative Murphy has another question for you, Dr. Sulik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it is ironic that we're hearing this today on Nurses Day. I don't think that was organized in that way. But I do just want to caution the department and maybe for those who are going to be working on this in pension. When others besides security officers were added to this pension in early retirement, the argument was made that because they share a similar risk in terms of exposure to inmates, the security officers, in this case the nurses, who are doing confidential exams, they're often one-on-one with the inmates, they often have scissors and other sharp instruments. The argument was made, and the legislature decided at that time, the security officers and others share a similar risk. And because they share a similar risk, they should be treated similarly in terms of early retirement. The early retirement was suggested as a benefit for people who were taking on extra risk in caring for this population. So while I understand that there's a proposal to make a cut in this area, I do think that we need to look at it carefully for its merits. I think we have to look at it carefully in terms of expecting that some of those working in a risky situation, caring for a serious population, may be doing it when they're no longer able to do it because they're aging. And I also think that we have to think through this and look at this through the lens of gender, because I do think that there is a gender issue here. And so I understand we need to make difficult cuts. I am not sure that I think this is the most prudent cut. I know that we're not going to be making the decision here by ourselves, and the pension committee is going to be dealing with this, but I did think it was really important that while we had the moment, that I would just bring those issues to your attention so you can think them through as well.
The Chair, Representative, thank you.
Yeah, and just Representative Thiessen, maybe is this going to be handled, would this be part of the pensions bill or would this be part of the human services bill where it would be finally tracking?
Mr. Chair, I imagine it would be part of a pension bill.
Yeah.
But I don't know where the money is getting, if there are savings, where that would get tracked. That's a different thing.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But the policy would go to the bill.
Another reason not to be on the pension.
Or to be on it.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Anyway, let's continue on to the next pages, and if there's time, we can come back and revisit whatever else people want to talk about. Thank you.
The next budgetary change page has to do with state operated services, and specifically the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services, or otherwise known as CAB. This is in reference to budget page number 142. The proposal at hand here is to change the CABS program from an enterprise structure program to an appropriated core safety net program. And I'll present to you the rationale behind this request at this time. The issue at hand is that CABS was authorized in 1999 to operate as one of the enterprise programs. Since 2004, it has experienced a decrease in utilization attributed to an increase in utilization of crisis support services, other community-based services. It essentially was trying to provide some clarity in its function, the identity of CABS as perhaps a subacute longer-term care program was still believed across community providers. I, having been one of those community providers, really struggled with understanding what really truly the clarity of the role of CABS really was to be and how we could best utilize it as within the community as a service and a resource for us. Essentially, at stake here is to identify that the role of CABS should be to care for those individuals identified as having the most complex care needs, specifically in three areas of specialty that have been identified across the state as enormous gaps in our current care services. One being providing care for individuals with complex neurobehavioral disorders, such as autism, along with severe behavioral dysregulation and aggressive behaviors. Also, the second group of specialty identification would be providing care for those individuals who have complex trauma care needs and who've had a history of pretty significant traumatic stressors and that are needing a very specialized trauma-based approach to care. And the third would be individuals who have pretty significant patterns of emotional dysregulation in the childhood and adolescent population, and there would be a very specific treatment specialty program for them. The idea here, as you all have heard me speak of before in, as part of a wider based transformation within State Operative Services, is to look at really providing clarity of who we are in State Operative Services, who we are truly charged to provide care for, and how we can best provide care for them. In the latter of how we can best provide care for them, the proposal is to not just rely on inpatient care for services for those individuals that are at that far end of the complex care needs spectrum. The idea is to provide not only inpatient, but also to provide step-down partial hospitalization, very intensive therapeutic programming and partial hospitalization program, as well as some ongoing outpatient monitoring and consultation and collaboration services between the State Operated Services CAP team members and the community mental health care providers team members, as well as primary care. So this redesign essentially invests $19.2 million over the biennium. However, there is an anticipated collections of $18.7 million over the biennium during this period of time based on the expansion of services in a much more focused area. The impact is to try to stabilize the funding for the program to fill in the current gaps in our current care system across the state, and essentially to identify that the role of the state-operated services is not only to provide a core safety net for adult mental health, but also for children, for child and adolescent mental health services as well.
Thank you. And okay, let's first come to order since we have a quorum. And then Representative Rood, also in honor of the day, would like to move the minutes.
I
would like to offer a short talk about the value of minutes.
No.
Attendees? Okay. Thank you, Representative Rood. Any discussion about the minutes? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Those are adopted. Back to you, Dr. Sulik. This is going a little better than the last topic, I think.
Yes.
Can you tell me, just I don't know much about this area either from past discussions, but can you tell me how it was an enterprise program? And Did they like make little toys or something? Was it just third-party payers or something?
Mr. Chair, the structure of the enterprise programs within state-operated services is they do not receive any state-appropriated dollars and are dependent solely on third-party payments in order for the sustenance of the program. The difficulty with that within providing services through CABs within state-operated services is, by and large, the identity of the role of the state to still provide care for the most complex means that the cost of care and the efficiency of the care has been, or the cost of care has been such that the reimbursement has not been adequate to provide that array of services in the way that it's been done thus far. So this is really a proposal for complete redesign of that particular program to really target the highest area of need in the state that's been identified.
Is it the same workers? The same place? Same clients?
Mr. Chair, the proposal would be that there would continue to be an inpatient program at Wilmer, where there currently is the only residing inpatient program. But there's also plans to look at geographically where the step-down partial and clinic programs for those individuals could be provided around the state, looking at a metro area location as well as looking at more of a northern Minnesota location as well. With our use of technology and collaboration, we can provide services across the state in a much more efficient way than we could have in the past, and we think that that's certainly doable.
And so you'll be going back up in 26 to more clients again, do you think? Is there been different levels at various places? Is that what you think?
Mr. Chair, I think the clarity there that you just mentioned is really important, is that looking at our utilization of purely inpatient beds has been a mistake in this particular program, because the type of services that these individuals with very complex needs have is such that they could be better served in a much more efficient manner with an array of outpatient services. So we don't anticipate hopefully going that back up to full, the total number of beds between Brainerd that was closed last year and Wilmer was, I believe, in the high 50s or maybe low 60s total. And we just foresee that if we can improve access and the provisions of these other array of services, that those numbers of beds are not going to be necessary for us.
And then just one last question. I have some piece another question after that. And so this is, these beds will stay open. This isn't a way to get rid of the bricks and mortar at Wilmer to create community base. Was that the long range plan to actually get rid of that? Or is this just a way to serve more people better? This comes up from time to time if you're new here about this, but people always want to know that question.
Right. Mr. Chair, the facility currently would be structured as a community-based inpatient unit under the cap structure currently in Wilmer. I think that what's important is the idea that we're not looking at getting out of providing inpatient services for those child and adolescents with complex care needs, but doing it in a much different way than before.
Representative.
Well, first of all, let me say thank you for recognizing this as not something that should be an enterprise program, because I think that is a significant change in the administration's position on this and the right direction to be going. We fought about this for a long time. But the other thing is the history of this facility in Wilmer and the one in Brainerd has not been really well. The relationship between the people that work there and the management has been poor, to say the least, and part of it is communication. And the answer you just gave Representative Abler's question is not the kind of communication that we... Well, I mean, I guess you got to say what you're going to say, and I saw the person come up and whisper in your ear about that as well. But it's really important that if you are planning on closing the bricks and mortar, they can start telling people about that now instead of dropping it on people later, because that's kind of been the history of that.
Yeah. Can I, Mr. Chair and Representative, I can certainly clarify, though, that there's no gap in understanding here. I can assure you that at this moment in time, that has not come up whatsoever in this discussion. And if that's really important to say, I'm very, very comfortable saying that at this point, we need to continue to provide an inpatient service in central Minnesota that serves the broader array of the region of the state, and potentially also looking at providing an inpatient program somewhere closer to the metro area as well, to serve this area as well. 2/3 of our child and adolescents live in the metro area, but the outstate area needs access to this type of service as well, and we really see the combination of the two. We don't have a proposal being presented to move that inpatient program outside of Wilmer, because that's where our staff is, that's where the facility is at this time. So I want to make certain that that's not misinterpreted in any way.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And then Dr. Slick, one thing else, and we'll move on to the next section. And the history has been, just to follow up on what Representative Heaton said, is that we have, those of us who have an RTC or the similar thing, or used to have in our districts, we're aware of the value of those and just thought the necessity. And so, but what happened is the programs would just move away. The people would leave and couldn't close the thing. But then, oh, we got this empty building. What do we do with it now? And it was a little bit of a dance, and we would try to pass a law, and there'd be work groups. And so you got the message. I appreciate that. Okay. So let's move on to the next, the final page.
So the final page also has to do with state-operated services. And under the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration, just to remind you that within state-operated services, there is a dental care services center, where essentially we have currently 5 dental clinics across the state that are under this administration. This is a request. This is on budget page number 144. And this is a request to shift dental services also to a safety net. Now, again, this is specific to the dental services provided through state-operated services, which was moved into an enterprise structure previously as well. The services provided by these clinics are limited to the provision of dental services for disabled persons. That is limited by statute. And if these individuals who are eligible for medical assistance, provided that the reimbursement received for those services is sufficient to cover the actual costs. The dental clinics were once operated as part of the regional treatment centers. That was the idea behind them, to serve the residents of the regional treatment centers. They have remained in existence because the population served within state-operated services have one of the greatest barriers to getting access to dental care, particularly the individuals with pretty significant developmental disabilities wind up being incredibly labor-intensive to provide care for in a dental clinic in a community-based setting. So these clinics have continued to operate under the mission that they're providing a service to individuals who literally would not be able to get this care virtually anywhere else. The action being proposed here is to invest $6.62 million over the biennium with an anticipated collection of $3.514 million. Those numbers alone demonstrate to you that this particular provision of care for these individuals is such that our current structure of reimbursement does not cover the cost to provide care for them in the manner that they need to have the care provided. So the impact of this is to fill in the gap in the system that's currently there and to preserve the safety net services that we are charged to provide in state-operated services.
Dr. Sluik, there's no change in the personnel or the building that they're at or anything like that. I have another question. Are these clinicians fully busy with their day? I noticed just the patient count and six a week or something. Is that a full, are those really hard patients, or is there some free time in their schedules? You know?
Mr. Chair, those are thought to be very labor-intensive patients. However, there is capacity in these clinics to increase services. Some of the limitations in some of the clinics is space. We have pretty limited space in some of them. I haven't been able to get out to all five of these clinics to see them visually myself. I've been reviewing the data that I have from these programs. I've seen the program. We do have a clinic also in Anoka that's not considered that wasn't one of the five, I don't believe, that I mentioned. But I think that there is capacity to improve services. Some of that improvement in capacity was taken into account when we estimated what the revenue would be generated from these.
And the reason I ask is that, you know, if we're going to fund these and there's some capacity, each area has some pretty severe dental needs in their different population that might be served there, especially since it's hard to find a dentist who is willing or has that kind of time to work on some of these complex, you know, medical assistance kind of cases. Thank you. Representative Vaughn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up to that question or comment, if I'm understanding. This provision of this service is for those currently in institutional settings that fit any of these three categories, if I'm correct. Is that correct? Or are they also in community-based group home settings as well?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the latter is correct. They're also in community-based group homes, but they just would not receive care elsewhere.
Just to follow up, and then what the question actually is, though, what about folks who are in these categories but not necessarily in group home but being cared for at home still? Do they have access to this if they fit these categories of individuals?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair and Representative, that's a question that I honestly don't know the exact answer to, but I would like, that's one that I've thought of myself and just wondering how we get access. The answer is
yes. You can actually talk to
the answer I'm being told is yes. They can access it.
Thank you, because I think particularly with this issue, if there's a capacity, it would seem everyone who's under some sort of assistance, wherever they might be residing, should be able to access this type of care that can deal with their conditions.
Right. Mr. Chair and Representative, one point of clarification I just want to bring reference to is I recognize that this is an appropriation request. The history of providing dental services within state-operated services has been really in question. What is the role of state-operated services to be providing dental care? We are the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration. That's a question I brought to the table immediately when I saw this. And I have to say that in really thinking through at a period of time when we have to be looking at efficiencies, this is an area that I really thought I could not comfortably try to let go of because the need for care for these individuals is so dramatic.
Representative Tao.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the governor's proposal, he zeroed out all dental care for anyone who's non-pregnant and over 18. Would this impact this population, that zeroing out?
Dr. Stewart.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the dental cover. All right, here's what I'm being handed. The answer is when this potential request, the revenue being generated was proposed, they have to go based on what's in law currently. So even though there's other budgetary pages elsewhere from the Healthcare Administration that look to remove dental eligibility for dental services for a number of people, that is not taken into account here. So there is an interaction, but it's not been accounted for in this page.
So they would still get dental care.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, to clarify what that means is, this: if we appropriate this service at $6.62 million, our estimated revenue that could be generated from collections at $3.514 million is based on current law. If eligibility for dental services in the public programs is reduced or eliminated, that it will impact that projected revenue being collected. It doesn't change our request for the appropriated amount.
Does that help? Is that that's the 50% share or the 100% fee? That is that just the state, the federal share that you are netting, or are you collecting all the money and then charging us to the 50% on the medical assistance budget?
Mr. Chair, the calculation is based on the 100% of collections, including the federal share.
Thank you. Who's next? Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Sulich. One of the questions that I have was in just reading this is that it says here that this is in our budget book for disabled persons who are eligible for medical assistance, provided that the reimbursement received is sufficient to cover actual costs. And by the way, this has nothing to do with the validity of people's needs. This is a discussion of methodology of how to provide it. And so it says it's sufficient to cover actual costs, and yet with this appropriation it's implying that you are not recovering the actual cost to provide this service, as it appears to be from the quote of the statute that it's required to do so. So I'm a little bit, why are you doing a appropriation if you're supposed to cover actual costs?
Dr. Sulich.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, currently the dental services is in an enterprise structure requiring the program to be covering through revenues generated its costs.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose for bringing this budgetary page change forward now is to say that that's been unable to occur, and therefore we're requesting that that service, rather than us eliminating it, that it be moved into appropriation. That's the purpose of bringing this forward currently.
Yeah, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a follow-up to that. When I look at this appropriation and then also the cost that you're doing, is there another way to accomplish this without having the state getting into the direct provision of dental service? As you said, state-operated services generally doesn't do this. I mean, our general model has been we have plenty of good dentists out there and lots of people who are dentists even in this program. Is there a way, especially if you're doing an appropriation, that we can use this in such a way that you don't have to have another situation here where you are creating a government dental clinic in competition with the private sector? And why not just, if you have an appropriation and you have these costs, just meet that need? Is there something unique here?
Dr. Stewart.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think the word competition with other the dental providers is really the point to have some discussion about. It's my understanding, after really learning about the clients served in this program, is that these are clients that really are too difficult to manage in community-based dental clinics. So we really see this as a resource available to community-based dental clinics to be able to have this service available to the state. And I think that if there was a program that emerged to say, you know, this really is our specialty, we really have staff that really can provide care for individuals with very complex developmental disabilities who have a behavioral dysregulation and anxiety that leads to them having 5 or 6 visits before they can get a treatment or an intervention provided, I think we'd be fully excited about supporting that. But so far in the history of our state, those individuals, that service hasn't emerged. And so we do see that this is not something competing, but it's something, it really is a resource to the rest of the dental clinics currently available in the state.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, you have the last question. We're going to move on to child care.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Sulich. Actually, I had almost the same question as Representative Tao about the fact that the governor's proposal is zeroing out dental care for MA recipients. And just to follow up, I think you did answer that, but you know, in the page here, we've got net fiscal impact, which is comes in at about $3 million. And basically, you're saying that if we were to adopt the governor's budget, this is completely inaccurate, right? And it would be that in addition to the, we'd have to add back in the revenues that you've subtracted out for only part of them.
Dr. Sewell.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, currently this estimate would not take into account any changes in the current reimbursement rates for eligibility for dental care. So if that is passed, then there is a broader interaction here, and so our proposed revenue dollar amount would be reduced significantly. Just to clarify, so in other words, the potential contribution back into the general fund would be reduced considerably. The size of the total appropriation request remains the same. It's what we have to reduce is what we can contribute back into the fund. That's what would be reduced.
That's on Lieberman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I just want to make the comment. You said that you considered whether you should eliminate this, and because of the sheer need of these people, that you didn't want to do that. And I certainly agree with that, but I have to say that I feel the same way about some of the other needs around the state, and certainly people who are, out there trying to earn a living at often at low-wage jobs and so on, the people that are on MA, a broad spectrum of them, I feel the same way. Right. But this is a pretty critical, relatively low-cost thing for most people, but if you don't do it, and then you wait until it's a high-cost thing, it can be a very high-cost thing, both for the fiscal terms and in terms of people's health and well-being. So, thank you.
Thank you. And Dr. Slick, a couple of questions for me, and then we'll just take a few questions on the general topics you brought, and then you can escape here. Most of the income is on MA. Medical assistance, is that the revenue stream generally? So the money that comes in is mostly from medical assistance?
Correct,
on the revenue side. Yeah. If there's any dentists around, they talk about how hard it is to make ends meet on medical assistance, and here's the state having to subsidize almost one for one with the. That's an interesting thing. And the second question, which I don't think I heard, was if we don't do this and leave it as an enterprise, are these clinics going to go out of business, or are they going to take a second job are the workers going to take on other jobs to make ends meet, or what happens to these programs saved that we add this money into it?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think at this point, when we look at what it's taking to sustain these services without a budget that is supporting their existence, it's going to be really hard to figure out how we can sustain five clinics with the revenue that they're generating independently. So I think at risk is the idea that they may, some of them at least, may very well have to be closed if that's the case.
Appreciate it. And that's good to know so we can judge. I guess Representative Kiffmeyer gets the last question here. You want to give another question, or are you done?
I just, when I was reading this and thinking about the very valid things that you bring forward, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Sulik, about excess capacity within these dental clinics were sold to communities, so part of your revenue that's represented up here in the 1757 comes from selling your capacity to communities?
Dr. Stewart.
I might want to phone
a friend there. They can come and talk if they want. They can actually sit down and tell us directly.
Phone a friend.
It'll be okay. Got it. Okay.
Thank you.
Dr. Stewart, how you doing?
It was the selling to communities that was getting me stuck. And what was clarified for me is that it wasn't that the services were sold to communities, but because of the capacity, non-disabled individuals on MA were able to, the access was opened up to them as well in some of these communities. That's what that meant. I would agree that the wording in the budgetary change page is a little bit confusing in that respect.
Now you've conjured up a question from our economist, so Representative Bond has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, the MA payment you received through this program from the other part of government came, this part of government, is it a higher payment because of the difficult to handle nature of these cases, or is it the same MA payment that everyone else received?
Dr. Sulik,
Chair, Representative, currently it's the same MA payment.
Well, I think we're just about done with this. Are there any questions on the three sections we talked about? If we have another 2 minutes, we could burn up with Dr. Sulik Fleischer. I think we'll let you get away while there's time, and we'll invite Mr. Johnson to come down to talk about children's services, not child care. Thank you, Dr. Sulik, and you. Appreciate your advice to us. You know, the audience, the next part's really interesting, too. Oh, this is your staff you brought with you, Dr. Sulik. I see this is... I think you better wait a minute.
I guess
so if you want to clear out that are going, if you're going, please go, but come again. And happy Nurses Day. Mr. Johnson, you have the people who are truly interested in hearing your conversation now. You've got the loyal listeners left and all of us. So we have 45 minutes to go through your whole topic, and I think what I'll do, just to make sure we get through it, if people have, do you have a lot of pages to go through?
Mr. Chair, I'm guessing there's about 12 or so here.
Yeah. And so I think what we'll have to do is just do the narrative for all 12 of those. And then people can take notes, and we'll fill up all the time at the end with questions. That should be a considerable time, but otherwise we'll find ourselves with some pages hanging, and there's no time left to reschedule you. So this is the end of the governor's proposal. So maybe there's some... And by the way, if I forget to tell you, take your books home with you at the end of class today, because the librarian is not going to be attending them any longer, apparently. So, Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Chuck Johnson, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services of the Department of Human Services. I'm starting on page 45. That's where we left off the last time on the budget discussion for Children and Family Services. Mr. Chair, this page addresses group residential housing modifications. This page includes four different changes. Two are revenue enhancements, and two are reductions in program benefits. The first change on this page affects, we believe that there are some folks within the GRH program now for whom we can get them onto the DD waiver, the development disability waiver, and therefore access federal reimbursement for some of the services that we're now paying for with 100% general fund dollars. The DD or the GRH program pays a difficulty of care rate. We have done this to be able to transfer some of these costs for the room and board earlier, I believe it was in 2003, to the DD waiver. We believe we can also do that with the difficulty of care portions of the GRH waiver. This, of course, allows us to access federal Medicaid reimbursement rather than paying 100% general fund for the dollars, which saves us $1 million in fiscal years 12 and 13 each. This page also includes an increase in the reimbursement from the food stamp program that comes to the group residential housing. People who are in group residential housing are eligible for food stamps. A few years ago, we started getting federal food stamp reimbursement for group residential housing. We believe we can expand that significantly. The waiver we moved through a few years ago was for the nonprofit GRH settings. We believe that under the waiver authority that FNS has available to them, we can expand that to include the for-profit group residential housing settings, which results in a savings or revenue to the general fund of about $14.4 million for the 10-11 biennium. The next set of changes are to the personal needs allowance and the community living adjustment. There are two levels of personal needs allowance currently in the GRH program. There's a higher personal needs allowance for those who come from an MSA basis of eligibility, and a lower personal needs allowance for those who have general assistance basis of eligibility. This proposal would put those personal needs allowance at the same level, $89 per month, which is a savings of the $20 per month that are currently is available to the MSA recipients, and that results in a savings to the general fund. In addition to that, we're also proposing that a few years ago there was put in place a community living supplement of $12 a month, which was anticipated at the time to help cover what were expected to be additional pharmacy costs. When Medicare Part D came along, it essentially made that not necessary for those who are on Medicare, and so we believe that we're also proposing to eliminate that community living adjustment. Those two changes together save about $7 million for the 10-11 biennium.
So that actually lowers it to be both the same, is that correct? The $20 thing?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. They'd be both at the $89 level, which means a reduction for those who have currently have the MSA basis of eligibility.
Thank you. I just have to ask one question to break my own rule here. if there's no spots in the DD waiver, how can you serve them in the DD waiver?
Mr. Chair, this actually would be not adding people to the waiver, but being able to claim more under the waiver for folks that are already in it.
I see. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm skipping the next page.
Members, if you're dying to ask a question, go ahead. But we just wanted to...
which is under the jurisdiction of the Early Childhood Committee and moving to page 49. This page includes several reductions to the Minnesota Family Investment Program. These are all reductions that are essentially issues that have moved back and forth in different directions over the course of the last several years in the legislature. This is mostly reinstating things that were undone in 2007. The first change, which would be effective July 1st of 09, in 2003, we put in place in state law requirements that any individual going to post-secondary education in MSIP also has a 20-hour work per week work requirement. That was lifted in 2007. This would reinstate it for a savings of about $1.1 million for the biennium. Effective February 1st of 10, under current law, if a family is living in subsidized housing, we reduce their MSIP benefit by $50 per month. This proposal would expand that to $100 per month for a savings of about $3.1 million for the biennium. In 2003, we began to count against the MSIP benefit, the SSI, Supplemental Security Income benefits that a family receives. That continued from 2003 through 2007. It was repealed in 2007. This would reinstate it effective March 1st of 2010, upon $125 per case of SSI income against the MSIP grant. And then the fourth change on this page, also effective March 1st of 10. In 2007, I believe it was, the vehicle asset limit was increased from $7,500 to $15,000. This reduces the asset limit back to $7,500 for a savings of $365,000 for the biennium. All these changes are made to help address the budget deficit. Mr. Chair, the next page, page 50, also affects the Minnesota Family Investment Program. In 2007, the legislature created a work participation cash benefit. This is essentially a benefit that is paid when a family exits MSIP and they're working. We'll continue to pay them under current law $75 a month for the next 24 months. It was a device that we put in place to help us meet the work participation rate because we can count these folks in our work participation rate. And, of course, they're the cases that are really successful with those that leave assistance and are working, and so it helps to be able to count them. This proposal would reduce that $75 per month benefit to $50 per month. For the savings that you see there on the page. This has not been implemented yet. It will be implemented October 1st of 09, so this won't affect any current recipients. It would only affect the program once implemented in October. We believe we can still achieve the same level of work participation rate benefit from this program at the $50 level as we had estimated at the $75 level. Mr. Chair, the next page, page 51, this is another change to MSIP. Under the current Minnesota Family Investment Program, a family exits the program at 115% of the poverty level. That is, when their income, their earnings reach 115% of poverty, that's when they go off of assistance. This proposal would reduce the exit level to 110% of poverty, moving it down for the savings of roughly $2 million for the biennium. Mr. Chair, the next page, page 52. This eliminates a grant that was put in place in 2007 called Integrated Services Projects. This was actually a project that the department started with discretionary dollars with seven counties and one tribe to test trying to bring together different human services for that part of the MSIP caseload that has multiple challenges and needs help not just through MSIP but also through mental health, chemical health, other kinds of services that we provide, really trying to test how counties could develop models for bringing those services together for these families with a particular focus on trying to develop models that would be sustainable without additional dollars. That is a way to change the service delivery system itself so that we could continue to effectively serve these individuals in our MSIP caseload. The legislature in 2007 actually provided money for this to continue those projects beyond what the department had initially funded. This proposal would propose to eliminate that funding for those projects. The savings are less in the first year because we have current contracts with the county, which we would continue through the end of the calendar year, and then would eliminate those after that. We did do an evaluation of the project. There was mixed success. Some of them looked promising, others not so much. As I said earlier, our original intent was that these would be self-sustaining, and so we're looking into the counties now to see if they will sustain these after the funding is removed. Mr. Chair, the next page, page 53, addresses the MFIP Consolidated Fund. The MFIP Consolidated Fund is essentially the block grant that we created in 2003 that we give to counties that they use to provide the services to MFIP families. There are three main purposes that they use the money for within the Consolidated Fund. A portion of it they use to help fund the cost of eligibility workers. A portion of the counties use, again, at their discretion, to fund emergency assistance for families. And the largest portion goes to provide employment-related services to MFIP and Diversion Work Program recipients. This proposal would reduce the funding for the Consolidated Fund by 5%, which when fully implemented would be a savings of about $5.5 million per year. The original language in the Consolidated Fund in 2003 included an allocation formula for counties on which 5% of the money we allocated to counties was based on performance. That by 95% was a formula based on their caseload, but the other 5% was based on how they actually performed on two measures that we used to measure county performance. In 2007, that language for performance funding was modified down to the point where essentially it's a paper process now, and counties continue to get that 5% without real regard to performance. We believe that given that no longer having the performance tied to the funding, that we would propose to eliminate the funding as well. Mr. Chair, the next page, page 54, is TANF refinancing page. Several of the pages that I just went through resulted in savings from the MFIP program, from the ISC grants, and from the Consolidated Fund grant. Those savings come to us in the form of TANF. This page takes those TANF dollars, refinances them to produce general fund savings to address the budget deficit. The amount here is about $35 million over the biennium. The mechanism for refinancing is to essentially take the TANF dollars, put them into the Child Care Assistance Program, take out a like amount of general fund from the Child Care Assistance Program, which we then can use to address the $4.8 billion deficit. This doesn't have any impact on eligibility, services, rates, or anything within the Child Care Assistance Program. It's purely an accounting kind of maneuver as to which dollars we put into Child Care Assistance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, we've had lengthy discussions about this, as you know. I think you're still going to bring to us how many times the legislature has done this in the past and how much that totals up to, or is that still making its way to my office, or Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Falk, I'm not sure the status of that. We do have that information, however.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, members, as you know, we do this over and over, and the difficulty in this is that we could potentially be using these funds for their intended purpose, in my mind, at least for child care, and instead we're using them to pay off the deficit. So it'd be interesting to know. I hope we can get the figures on that and what that adds up to over the years we've done that. Thank you.
Fair question. Mr. Johnson, Reverend Peterson, go ahead. Two questions, Mr. Chair. The first, on that performance tied to funding, when that originated, when that was first enacted, that took, say, if they were paying $100 to the county to do that, and then they said we're going to pay 95, and then if you meet these criteria, we're going to pay the extra 5. And now we're just saying we're not going to pay the extra 5. So that is kind of a cut. I mean, right now the county should automatically get that 5 anyway, kind of without regard to performance. So this is a 5% reduction in funding to counties for that stuff.
Mr. Representative,
that's all right. Okay. And the other question I had is really the stimulus package. And I don't know if you know for sure, we had a little bit of discussion yesterday on the floor about this. Are there any as I understand, the TANF is like an emergency fund we can tap into under in the stimulus package out of that we can tap into for certain things if we have higher demand. Are there any strings attached to eligibility or any other kind of policy reforms that we'd be limited to if we tapped into those emergency funds that you're aware of?
Mr. Chair, excuse me, at this point, no, there are no strings. None of those types of strings attached to it. As you said, it's money that we can access. It's essentially 80% reimbursement if we have increased costs or make an increased investment in certain areas. So it's not money that will come to us automatically. It's only if we're seeing increased costs that we can get that reimbursement. We have to apply for the dollars.
And we can make changes to the program, Mr. Chair, that we want. But still tap into those dollars.
Mr. Chair, that's our current understanding.
Okay, thank you.
Well, keep going, and then we'll come back and chat about this stuff some more if people want. So.
Oh, I thought he was done. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's fine.
Okay,
no, it's great. Good question. Go ahead, Mr.
Mr. Chair, the next page is page 55. This is essentially a technical page. There were errors made last year in the appropriations riders. This page corrects those errors, the results being, as you can see, a cost of $189,000 in the first year, $199,000 in the second year to the general fund. Mr. Chair, the next page is page 56. This page proposes to eliminate two grants that were created in the 2007 session. These were both targeted grants to particular organizations in the community. One is a young parent program that focuses on teen parents in Minneapolis. The other is a program that focuses on lodging and psychiatric services to homeless people with mental illness. I believe that program is also located in Minneapolis. And we're proposing to reduce these largely because they were narrowly targeted grants to particular organizations. Mr. Chair, the next page, page 57, is the federal compliance page. The federal 2002, the Congress passed the Improper Payments Information Act. This allows the Office of Management and Budget to review the federal budget, essentially identify programs where they believe there's a risk of money that may be misspent or improperly paid, and then to set up regulations around how those programs should be reviewed regularly to ensure that we're not making improper payments. They have added the Child Care Development Fund to that list of programs that we now have to do reviews on. This will require us to do 276 case reviews a year, and then do essentially corrective action based on the individual case we look at, and also identify where there are patterns and how we're administering the program and is it working right, so we can do a better job of training and doing a better job of making payments going into the future. Because the federal government is requiring us to do this, we do need an FTE to accomplish this work, and this page includes essentially the cost of that FTE.
Mr. Johnson, since we're, you're still a couple pages left, right?
I'm sorry, Mr.
You're still a couple pages left, is that right?
One
page. Well, let me ask you a question then about this. You don't expect to recoup much money from the system changes you'll be making, and never mind the individual small pots of money you'll be getting. I don't see any add back for only $40,000. I think there's no system things to find. Is that what you expect? Or?
Mr. Chair, it's kind of hard to say at this point because we haven't done this before with the Child Care Assistance Program, what might happen. I mean, obviously, we do now identify cases where there are payments that are made wrong. We do go through the process of collections and so forth. How much additional this would provide because we're reviewing these cases systematically, we didn't feel comfortable making an estimate on that.
Thank you. Yeah, go on. We'll do the last page, and we'll come back and take questions.
Mr. Chair, the last page on page 58. This is also a page that would provide additional revenue to the general fund. In 2000, and I believe it was 5, we started an initiative in which we are able to tap food stamp employment and training, federal reimbursement, to offset some of the costs within the MFIP program. What we started with in 2005 was we can use the food stamp employment and training revenue, which is 50% reimbursement, to offset the cost of some of the cases in MFIP that we don't include in our TANF program. We fund entirely with general fund as non-maintenance of effort programs, which we usually do for the purposes of trying to help us with our work participation rate. One group we have in that right now is the two-parent families, and so we started in 2005 to tap the FSET revenue for the services, to the employment services to the two-parent families, and we're getting about $2.4 million a year for that. That rider that authorized that maneuver is sunsetting, so we want to reinstate that rider so we can continue to collect the $2.4 million. We also believe that we can now get FSET reimbursement on the child care for the two-parent families as well, which is why you'll see the numbers on the budget page are actually larger than the 2.4 we're currently getting. We believe we can grow this to about $4.3 million by 2011 in additional FSET revenue to the general fund.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I should mention this page also includes an FTE to help us with that work. It's very complicated, and as we expand this, we want to have the proper resources to be able to administer it.
And is that the whole?
That is it for children and family.
Well, members have been very well behaved waiting for questions. I know, Representative Liebling said she wasn't going to behave anymore. So go ahead, you can have the first one. You can have the second one, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, going back to the TANF refinancing, are we still facing a possible $10 million sanction from CMS for our previous TANF refinancing? What happened to that?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, we're not facing any penalty for TANF refinancing. We may face a penalty for not meeting our work participation rate in 2007. We believe that we have not gotten a letter yet from HHS advising us as to whether or not we've met the rate for 2007, so we're still kind of in the dark as to where they are, although based on our data, we believe we didn't meet the work participation rate. Whether we actually have to eventually pay that penalty or not depends on a bunch of other factors. In particular, we won't pay it immediately because we would put a corrective compliance plan in place and work that plan for 2 years, and we're hopeful that we won't have to end up paying that penalty at all. But that was not related to TANF refinancing. That's related to the work participation rate.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what's the magnitude of that potential sanction?
Mr.
If we do get one.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, the initial penalty we think for the work participation rate would be the $10 million level. That can increase incrementally each year if you continue to not meet the rate up to what would be a cap for Minnesota of about $21 million. What we have now with federal regulations is a process that we think will allow us to meet the work participation rate going into the future through a device that's called excess maintenance of effort, which allows us to claim additional maintenance of effort that we have existing within the state's budget now. So we're hopeful that we're not going to have to pay work participation rate penalties.
Only two. Okay. Left and a half.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and kind of off onto the point of work participation. With the work bonus that we had at $75, that was implemented because we thought it would allow us to meet those work participation guidelines. How are you coming to the assumption that 33% reduction in that bonus will not impact work participation rates?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hosh, it's a good question, and there's not hard data out there for us to base this on. It's based on our best judgment and the best judgment of the people who do the fiscal notes as to there's a certain hassle factor that goes with continuing to do your reporting or whatever to get this money. And we believe that the $50 level is high enough that people will continue to go through that process. We believe if we went below $50, then we would start running into some drop-off in the participation, which means we would get less value for our participation rate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that, I mean, if we're getting close to that threshold, I mean, if this is something that we consider, we have to make sure that there's some safeguards for us to monitor our performance. I'm sure the department can provide us that, but we don't want to see that sanction, especially if it means, just an extra $25 for a work bonus. Another question, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
Okay. One of the things I'm concerned about is the reduction or requiring the 20 hours of work alongside post-secondary education. And study after study shows that those who do pursue educational opportunities do not recidivate back onto MCEP. What kind of impact do you think this would have with recidivism? Because we know that those with less than high school education reoccur on our rolls much more than those who do have post-secondary education.
Mr. John.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hosh, there's no estimate here of any recidivation or any caseload effect at all. The savings that are on this page actually come from more people working than would be working otherwise on the assumption that they would work in order to continue to go to school. They work, they earn income, their grant goes down, we get some small savings from that.
One more question, Mr. Chair. And I mean, this change page here has essentially four different policy changes. What exactly, the one on requiring 20 hours of work with post-secondary education, what exactly does that save us?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hosh, that saves us $366,000 in fiscal year 10 and $741,000 in fiscal year 11.
That's been high.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I want to welcome Representative Solberg here on this momentous day. We're on the final page of the governor's proposed budget. So, you, how about that? Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson. I just had a question on page 45. But I waited a long time because I wanted to be a good kid here on the committee. But,
you get points, there's
yeah. Regarding the group residential housing, I just had a question. Would that be group residential housing for a program such as Teen Challenge, which also includes for adults a faith-based program? Would they be one of the groups that would be in this group residential housing grant?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi, this is a program for adults, not for youth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, the one on page 45 is for adults, not youth?
Well, unless Mr. Elgar is going to come and correct me.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, and I was just going to say that the Teen Challenge is for youth and adults, so that's why I thought it might have fallen under this.
Mr. L, you're allowed to talk here compared to the Mr. Zulik staff, who's a little shy. So.
Dwayne Elg, I work in the Community Partnerships Division of the Department of Human Services. The changes for group residential housing would, in fact, impact Teen Challenge. The reduction in personal needs allowance, all of the residents who are receiving group residential housing would have a reduction in personal needs allowance in Teen Challenge.
And then a second follow-up to that, I was just curious because I've been visited by some people from that program, and I was wondering if that program is in fact working. I mean, there were people in my office who had been through chemical dependency treatment maybe 7 or 8 times, and now we're in the Teen Challenge program. And I'm wondering, since we're paying for the group residential housing, are those programs in fact effective? Are we getting our money's worth out of that program?
Mr. Chair, Representative, based on the information that's been provided by Teen Challenge themselves in terms of their success rate, yes.
That's from Sheldon. And I'm sure why you're here, Mr. Elg. When people are in other just general group residential housing, I just heard an anecdote, which I will, since you're here, it's all too easy to ask. This person was encouraged to not work for fear of actually getting income, so they'd have to leave the group housing. Is there any, and that made my wheels turn a bit, is there any kind of requirement that people receiving these services get any other services or do any other actions?
Mr. Chair, there are two bases of eligibility for group residential housing. One is that you're receiving supplemental security income, SSI, and the other is that you're eligible for general assistance due to a disabling condition that prevents you from working. Currently, if you are on general assistance and receiving group residential housing, if you earn more than the income standard to be eligible for general assistance, you lose your general assistance. If you lose your general assistance, you lose your housing. And so if you, today, if you were to earn $302 a month, you would lose your general assistance and subsequently lose your housing. So for some, that is seen as a disincentive to work.
And, you know, and it's, you know, this is going to be quite a challenging session, and you're more aware of the details of that than I am. Because you live in the, you've worked there in this world, and you've been around a long time. But is there somewhere to go? As some of these, I treat people on general assistance in my clinic, and there's a bell curve of capability in that group. And are there some folks that are getting general assistance now that could be trained and put in the workforce centers and let them help them out of this place so they aren't trapped in this? And some, I understand, they're more hard to get out of there. Do you have a thought about that?
Mr. Chair, we have anecdotal information from many of the partners in our Housing First project in Hennepin County, wherein we've taken people off the street who've been homeless average 10 years or more, who have subsequently stabilized just with the housing and would work but for the loss of housing. So these are people who are disabled through chemical dependency, mental health, co-occurring disorders, who have stabilized and probably could work, but would lose their housing.
And so it just seems like it begs for a way to help, like we did with some of the exit on the MSIP stuff. There's a GAMS exit program that could be done, something could be done probably thoughtfully that would encourage them to... Anyway, it just happened recently, so that's my thought. So Hayden, did you have your hand up there?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think on that note, one of the things that we can do is to look at the requirements that we have for GRH, the dollar amount. So I think the $302 or the standard for GA may be a tad bit low, and that increasing that, though I know that looking at Mr. Johnson, that might cause an increase in terms of what we pay, but that might be the difference between someone who is just starting to work part-time and making just over $300 versus, say, $700 or $800, where they, if they get to that level, they may then be a lot more stable and then thus be able to move off. And so I think that there is a bill that I'm going to sponsor that is going to help with that. So I just wanted to kind of maybe make Commissioner Johnson a heads up that I think that there is a threshold that goes from, you know, just working part-time, getting on your feet, versus working to a much higher level that then when you leave, you can actually pay for your housing or at least look for some other supplemental help to do that.
Like a general assistance exit plan.
Yeah.
And that'll help. Other...
Sir, when I went through this page the first time, there is an impact on this page from the stimulus bill. The stimulus bill increased the food stamp allotment, and so that means that the revenue we should be able to get from food stamps to the GRH program should also go up, and you'll see that we expect in a supplemental page from the governor's budget, supplemental budget.
There'll be a lot of pages that will be supplemental on that. Representative Fowler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I didn't realize I was interrupting before, so I'm sorry about that. I guess I wasn't a good kid, like Representative Scalzi, so here I am. Mr. Johnson, I just wanted to ask about page 49, the proposals. You know, they don't seem that big, maybe to people like you and me, but when we're taking people who are already on subsidies and don't have a lot of money and we're asking them to pay more per month, $50 is increased up to $100, and then reinstating the $125 SSI provisions. Can you tell us about the thinking behind that? You know, everything that I read on sort of folks that are struggling or low-income people, that $100 a month more in their pockets can make a significant difference in their lives. It can mean lessening domestic abuse in their family. It can mean they have enough money to buy some things for their kids, but yet this proposal seems to take yet more money out of their pockets. Can you tell us about that and why you're proposing that?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Plowick, these are hard choices, certainly, and certainly there will be an impact on the families that are affected by it. MPIP is a reasonably large part of the budget that I have, and when everything's on the table, we're looking at everything. These two reductions that you talked about are, the intent there is to target those reductions to families that we know have other income. rather than doing something more broadly that would it might affect those who are living just on the NSIP grant of $532 a month and don't have subsidized housing or SSI income or anything else to help keep their family going. And so it's certainly going to affect them, but relative to other families in NSIP, we felt like this was an appropriate place to target the reductions.
So, and so in total, how much does that raise by doing that? Is that because then you have the car part in there too as well, but those two together, was it?
Mr. Chair and Representative Slough, the total of those two is about $16.3 million. Most of that, $13.2 million, is in the SSI change.
Okay, thank you.
I have another. We don't have to spend the whole time. I appreciate your questions and your answers, Mr. Johnson. You know, at some point we're going to have to put together a budget, and a lot of these people will be on the inside of that. And is there, I'd be interested to see what the page after this would be that, you know, if you had to go another $100 million or so, what you would have done. And I don't want to ask that, but it would be, just to summarize what you've got on the table here, you didn't enjoy this process, and I know that, just to speak on behalf of the department people I've met. This has been, 2003 was very difficult for me to sit through all that and to be part of that. But you have to balance the budget somehow. And so you, I presume in terms of not questioning motives, but just even affirm that they were there, that this is the best you could do with finding this much money in your budget. And the next page was even worse stuff that you found even more difficult to do. And maybe that's just a comment, not a question, but I, that's the task we have in front of us. Representative Bauer.
Well, Mr. Chair, since we're going to get into philosophies and choices.
Go ahead, yeah.
There are choices here. I mean, the Health and Human Services Committee has always had the tough choices, I think. And a lot of you have been on this committee before. But, you know, these are people who are usually the most needy, whether it's physically, mentally, income-wise. And it seems that there are choices the governor has made. He has decided to place his cuts disproportionately in these on this committee and on the people that are affected by this committee. You know, we're out in these hearings, and I don't know if some of you have been on those, but last night in Woodbury, I mean, we heard over and over from the disability community that they felt these cuts weren't fair and how they were going to affect their families. We heard in Mankato of the difficulties these cuts are going to cause. We know that when the next week, since you opened this up, Mr. Chair, we know that next week when the forecast comes out, and it's probably going to be worse, there are going to be choices again. And, you know, this House and the Senate, we will be putting budgets together. You know, but we will not, we don't know, but we will have choices as well. And I think that our choices probably will look a little bit different than this. And we will hopefully, what we're hearing, at least in Woodbury last night, we heard is spread the pain, you know, spread it among everybody. Right now, this budget doesn't do that.
And just before I forget, I wanted to ask Mr. Johnson a question. Or Mr. Gottwald wants to go next. And I'm trying to keep this normal. And you're fine. Mr. Johnson, the forecast comes out in a week. I'm sure you're busily working on some other pages that feel like even less. When do you think that the change pages are going to come out?
Do you think, Mr. Chair, I don't know what the timing of that is.
Is it going to be, I think we're a week past that time, 2 weeks? Just do you have even a ballpark idea?
Mr. Chair, I've heard a week and I've heard 2 weeks. But as far as I know, there is not.
Don't be a month case at this point. A couple of weeks, and Representative Solberg probably knows.
Sure, I wasn't going to talk today.
Oh.
But we are working with Mr. Hansen, and with all the diligence on his part, so he is working with all the agencies to get this done as soon as possible. I had a meeting with him just shortly, and he has stressed that it's in his best interest to get these things done. It's in our best interest to get it done as soon as we can after the March 3rd. I also have to have an understanding that there's going to be a huge change from normal budget proceedings. Usually there's a few changes, and this one's going to be some massive changes on two levels. I think on the budget forecast itself, and also the federal, how the federal stimulus package works in, particularly in with this budget. So all I can tell you is he's assured me, and I'm sure that the agencies are working very diligently to put together the change packages that need. Okay. There may be completely different pages created, but if that has to be the case, that has to be the case.
Thanks, and it's good to have you here anytime you want to come. Representative Gottwald.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we opened up the discussion, Representative Flawick, what I have been hearing out there, and I don't know who's been lining up the testifiers at these hearings, but what I've been hearing is that most of them are from one side and not from another. But when I go out and have my own town hall meetings and hear from my constituents, I'm hearing a lot of them saying, get the job done. You need to balance the budget. We're going to be $7 billion in the hole. What are you doing about it? And the truth is, when you have this percentage of our budget in health and human services, and you're looking for places to reduce state spending or reduce the deficit, you don't have a lot of extra choices. And my response to the comments is basically, if you don't like what the governor's proposing, tell us how we should do it. Where are we going to raise the taxes? We talked about spreading it and fair taxes and those sorts of things. I hope we're going to have a good discussion here in this committee about those trade-offs, because those things too have impacts, both to people in need as well as people who are struggling to keep their jobs and so forth. So it makes sense when you see the percentage of the budget that's taken up with health and human services that's a place we're looking to trim and cut. We expanded eligibility over the last couple of years. I share the concern about the most vulnerable, but I also, I'd love to hear the way we're going to do this.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I feel compelled to join this discussion as well. I mean, this is what we need to be discussing. This isn't about the minutia on the page. This is about the big picture, and I appreciate Representative Flawick as well as yours, Representative Gottwald. Frankly, you know, if we're going to say, here's the small place where we have to make cuts to meet our budget, then indeed the choices are very limited. I mean, we are in a situation where no matter what we do, we're going to be making very difficult choices. But I've been saying all along that we need to all share in the solution. And in the governor's budget, he's cutting taxes to corporations, which many people agree that's not the best tax in the world, but in this year to be proposing a cut to taxes, you can't look at this and say, I'm forced to make this choice to cut the poorest of the poor. I just have to when you're also cutting those other taxes as part of the budget. And I believe that we all are going to need to share in the solution, which includes most especially the wealthiest Minnesotans who have not been asked to share in it. And, I just think that whatever we do, cuts or tax increases, it all impacts our economy. And everything we do, we have to have an eye to that on both sides of that equation. But I really think that going after the poorest of the poor who, in fact, don't show up at those meetings and aren't here hiring lobbyists and are pretty much unable to defend themselves in this process, to me, that's just wrong. And, you know, if they have to share in the pain, then they will, but not, in my mind, before everybody else shares, too. And I don't see that happening in the governor's budget.
I didn't mean to go down this road as far as we're going. And I think it's valid, but we are just going to have one heck of a session here. And the people are going to retain their beliefs through the process. Let me just remind people how the process is going to go. And then I think we're going to adjourn before we get too far on this. This is going to be the most challenging human service budget exercise in the history of the memory of Representative Fulbert. Since he's the... Oh, yeah, he's even forgotten it. But, I mean, I only have 11 years, and I'm, the senior person in the room, except for you. And so it's never been like this before. Never been like this before. And if the floor yesterday was mm-hmm. not a good start, and however you characterize what either side was doing, it's not a productive way to go about it. We're gonna that we'll be given a target. We'll be Dustin Solberg will more or less sit at the table and say, "Here's your target," and it's gonna have a minus in front of it. And probably, at least off the forecast, certainly be a minus, and maybe absolutely be a minus. But whatever it's going to be, this committee will be charged with hitting that target in the most thoughtful, constructive way we can. Ideas like soft landing GA to get rid of some of the GA people who could move along while not harming people who are well served in other general assistance programs. And it's going to take all our best. And I hope that as this process unfolds, we can all give it our best. And part of that is keeping our relationships healthy between each other. And I'll assure you that Republicans are not agreed on everything, and I would gamble Democrats are not either on how they would do this. And it's going to have to be the more it moves into the body, with certain parameters involving a governor and other forces way beyond our control, we'll have to hit the target. And that debate that rages about number of taxes and so on, the first target will be probably including some revenue, I would predict. That'll be easier. The real target later may be another number. We'll have to solve that one as well, and the better we work together, the better it's going to go. So, anyway, I think we're just going to call it a day here. I think our time is well spent. And sorry to those who didn't get to offer all the comments. Yeah, did you want to say something?
Yes, I did. I appreciate your spirit, Mr. Chairman. I certainly concur with all of that, but being patient sometimes. And I think in responding to those things that reducing the increase is not the same as a cut. And having come from a situation where in my office I was cut, that means less than the year before. That is very different than not getting as much as you hope for. And in this situation, when you look at Health and Human Services proposed increase as the sales were going on up to 20% and the governor proposing 9.7% increase, I don't think defining that in that way is really fair to him to do that. So, and having been at the listening sessions and others as well, I think there was a lot of representation of folks that you referenced. And so I think including all of them in this process, and certainly, Mr. Chairman, as your comments were made, I think avoiding construing people's motives is something that this body really needs to adhere to. Because I think we all care, but sometimes we might have a little different way of getting there.
I think Representative Bunn wants to tie it all together, and then we're going to be done.
I want to do a closing harmony comment here. Because I have felt in listening to the listening sessions and town hall meetings this last week that most of us are getting what the real problem is, missing what the real problem is on both ends of this debate. We are no longer just talking about a long-term struggle between, you know, small government, lower tax folks versus other folks that might be able to expand safety nets. Those of you that sit on this committee with me and have for years, many of you, know that the real long-term problem is an unprecedented, in all of world history, challenge that the nexus of aging, disabilities at the both ends of the age spectrum, and high-cost medical care that we've never faced before in our lives, that's going up faster than inflation, income, and productivity. And that is bigger and beyond that classic philosophical tension. And that all of us are responsible of solving that. And none of us is even close to solving it yet. So we must all bring together at this table beyond this session, you know, back to the discussion of health care, human service, delivery reform. That's where we all have to meet, because there's an endless stream of deficits ahead of us without addressing that fundamental problem that is outside the bounds of the normal historical struggle about philosophy.
Thank you, members. I appreciate all your work. Take your books with you. We're adjourned.